Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I am so happy that I have a wonderful guest right now to talk to. Somebody who, when I always tell all my listeners who are writers and they are asking me questions all the time, how can I get better? What advice do you have? I always say, paint a picture. And so I am so happy to welcome to somebody who really knows how to paint a picture. And I think that, you know, I have to say something before I introduce her. People, you've got to read this. If you are a writer, you have to read the first chapter of this book. It is wonderful. The name of the book is Impervious, a Sean McPherson novel. It's book three, and it is written by Lori Buchanan. Hi, Lori.
Hi, how are you, Patsy?
Okay, great. We're getting a little echo there.
Yes, I hear that.
What's happening? Okay, I think we got it now. Are you okay?
I'm good.
Okay, we got you. Okay, wow, Lori, you are amazing.
Thank you.
Know, as I said, the name of the book is Impervious. And when I sat down and started that first chapter, well, one thing I have to say about you, in some ways you are just so awful because you're just horrible because you write about food in this book. Now, I love books that have food in. But there should be a warning on the cover. Have your snack ready before you start reading. Because I started reading and I didn't have anything with me. I just plopped down. I'd been over to Tampa and I'd driven all the way back to here in Clearwater, Florida. I was tired and I sat down and I started reading and then I was like, what am I going to do here? A little ways in, it didn't take too long before I'm saying, I need some food because you write you write about food very well. I don't know.
Thank you.
I don't know if you did that, worked for a food magazine, but you are great at it.
Thank you very much.
Well, and of course it has, and the reason that I was hooked right away is in the very beginning, you have a little chart, a little layout of the writer's retreat.
And yes,
I love writer's retreats. I want to go on one, and I particularly want to go on one up in your neighborhood. Because
the Pacific Northwest is drop dead gorgeous.
It is, and I've read and about so many of the wonderful writing retreats there, and many of the authors who have come out of those writing retreats have been on Joy on Paper.
Woohoo!
And so I was torn there. So I'm reading, and then this first chapter. It was so refreshing and so much fun. And you write from different points of view. But first of all, your descriptions are so good that you take us right into the location. First of all, I don't want to give away the beginning of this first chapter because I was surprised by the character. I was surprised by, how can I say, you turn things upside down because we're not expecting the character perhaps to be as knowledgeable about a certain subject. And so that was so much fun. That was so refreshing. I thought, oh, I love it. And you're quoting all these wonderful things that I love, Conan Doyle, and it's just, all of that is delightful. And then we get to a police station. Now, there have been so many many descriptions of a police station. But when I get to yours, I could picture it. I could see it. And again, an unexpected twist that we have mm-hmm. we have a police officer, and then there's a twist to that. And so I'm yeah. getting this feeling. I'm saying, this is all in the first chapter. What am I going to do? I'm hungry. But then I was so cozy because it had been really cold. We had a cold spell here. Well, we call it cold when it hits, 50 degrees. So my bones were chilled, and I didn't want to get out of my nice comfy chair. And I knew I was in trouble. You must have had so much fun writing this book.
I do. I love writing the Sean McPherson novels. They're so much fun. And you opened this with saying, painting, and I paint a word picture. That's my goal, is to put the reader into the pages of the book.
Oh, you do. Oh, you do. I advise people, before they read this book, also make sure you go to the bathroom and come back, put the snacks next to you, and be ready not to move again, because it's just so much fun. Because the writer's retreat, I love the little layout. I was imagining myself going from cabin to cabin, and it's called Pines and Quill, which is such a perfect, that's perfect, perfection. I just, everything about this book is just delightful. And of course, tell us about your, and the nice thing, it starts with a wedding, and I always mm-hmm. like books that have a wedding in it. Mm-hmm. I had to wait for 12 books for Carol J. Perry to finally get her characters married. And my sister and I were going crazy. We kept saying, when's she going to get, she's got to get this girl married.
That's funny.
So here you got married in book three.
Book three, yes. I've got an 8-book contract, and there's a baby coming in book five. And I'm having a blast writing this. And it's all based on my stay at Hedgebrook, which is a women's writing retreat on Whidbey Island off the coast of Washington State. And I got to stay there, and I was put in the cabin that was secluded by trees. And we had to put in our own firewood. I mean, they chopped it for us, but they taught us how to use the wood-burning stoves within our cabin. And then at night, we'd all meet at the main house, and we would eat a meal together, all of the writers in residence, and we would share the day's ups and downs. So this is very much based on my experience there.
Oh, and as I said, because you paint this picture, we can feel it. We can, and having the little layout, we're imagining ourselves going from place to place. Everything about it is absolutely wonderful. Now, tell us about your main characters, because they are... Well, they are going to be one of these power couples in mystery history. That's it.
So Sean Mick McPherson. His name is Sean McPherson, but everybody calls him Mick. He is a gentleman who had been a police officer. He'd been in a horrific accident, and he lost his ability to walk for quite some time. Was in a wheelchair. It not only took a toll physically, but mentally and emotionally, he suffers from survivor's guilt. So he came to his sister and brother-in-law's, Pines and Quill, to be a groundskeeper and handyman and that type of thing. Each month, 4 writers in residence come, and he meets Emma Benton. And Emma Benton is in a wheelchair from complications due to transverse myelitis. Anyway, they fall in love, and... Mick is able to walk again, and I won't spoil that. He's able to walk again. He decides to become a PI, a private investigator in the state of Washington, one that carries a gun. And he's very good friends with the local homicide detective and also a Seattle-based special agent, FBI agent. And they work together quite often on a joint task force to fight Giorgio the Bull Gambino, who has a trifecta of towns, which is in New Orleans, in San Francisco, and Seattle. And he runs drugs. He traffics drugs and weapons and humans. And so their battle is against this guy and his minions. And it's so fun to write. And so Sean is amazing. In book 3, you mentioned a wedding. He marries Emma. And we have Hemingway, who's the Irish wolfhound. Most people, when they write reviews, they write about Hemingway, who's based on my real-life Willa, Irish wolfhound. And I have just so much fun bringing these characters to life. They come, they stand up out of the pages.
They certainly do. You have a, you've just peopled it with wonderful, wonderful characters, including somebody who knows how to cook. And that is what, I mean, it was really torture there for a while. I had to, eventually I had to get up and get something. I got in quite a ways before I finally, you know, just got up out of my chair and got something to eat because I was inspired. So tell us about that.
Well, that is Neil McCullough. He's one of the two owners. He's married to Libby, who's Nick's sister. And Neil is a phenomenal cook. He's a gourmet cook, and he pairs his meals with wines. And I talk about it. And Neil is based on my husband. My husband is a phenomenal cook. So everything, every meal that I write, we have tried. We have eaten. We've paired the wines. And I can write about it because we sit down. And I'll say to him, okay, honey, I need a breakfast. Okay, honey, I need a picnic lunch. I need a this, I need a that. And pair it with a wine for me. So he'll put it together, he'll serve it, I'll taste it, I'll say, oh yeah, this is it, and then I write it.
I love this guy. I mean, the guy in the book, but I love your husband too.
Yes, yes.
Well, you know, that's what one thing writers need, female writers particularly, we really do appreciate men who cook because my husband was also the cook in the family. And that's why, you know, at one point somebody said, well, you know, when I started the program, I said, you know, I've read 10,000 books. And people would say, well, how could you possibly? I mean, you're married, you've got kids. You can't do that. I said, but I have a husband who cooks. And cleans.
Yes. So, oh, that's nice.
You know, he was a military guy. You know, he learned how to do things right. I could never make a bed like he can. So, you know, aren't they wonderful?
Yes, yes, yes. My husband's retired military as well. And they do. Those men and women, they come out just so incredibly organized and talented and skilled, yes.
And trained. I mean, they're trained.
Yes.
They're trained to do it, and they don't object to do it. I mean, because, you know, they never complain to a general. And so they just do it.
Yes. Yes, yes.
So no wonder you have time to write 8 books.
Yes.
Oh, as I said, this retreat is so delightful, and I want to, I have to do it. I have to go to the one that you went to, of course, is absolutely fantastic. That's the kind of retreat I need to go to. I have only been to one writer's retreat.
And that was
a little bit different. It was at the Houstonian Hotel in Houston, which is a very luxurious hotel tucked way in the woods. People are always so surprised that there's a wooded area in Houston on a little hill, and right there is this very luxurious hotel. And there was a writer's retreat there. And I mean, I was married, and I wasn't a resident. I just did, you know, from 6 in the morning to, well, late at night. Because in those days, let's say, Ken Kesey was the main person speaking, of course, you know, with the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. We all sort of got a little cuckoo, and there was an enormous amount of drinking, and we spent most of our time, I don't know how much we learned about writing, but we certainly had a lot of fun. I need one of these really, you know, rustic settings.
Yes, yes, yes.
But pair it with some wine for dinner at least.
There you go.
Well, I just, you know, I am in awe of you because you're writing. I know you've won so many awards. Do you want to say some of them off the top of your head? I mean, when you
let me get to that page.
Yeah, you get to your page. You get to your book.
I have to look. Yeah, I got the Eric Hoffer award. I was a finalist. I got the PenCraft Literary Excellence. I got the Clue finalist. I got the International Book Award winner, the gold there. I got the National Indie Excellent Award gold. I got the Reader's Favorite finalist. I got the Top Shelf finalist. I got the Forward Indies winner.
She's gonna
the
be
Nautilus. I got quite a few.
You got a lot of them. I think that's enough for right now.
And I have fun. And if even though I treat it as a business, writing is a business, it doesn't feel like a job. Every writer has to, this is a business. You have to market and you have to do your publicity, but it doesn't feel like a job.
Oh, no. When you're having so much fun writing about characters who I'm sure have taken over much of your life.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And which it makes it so much fun. And then you can include all sorts of, well, I don't know. We didn't even talk about the mystery in this book. I don't want to give things away. But yeah, there it. Let's just say this is a wedding with a bang.
There you go. That was a perfect way to put it.
And we have a lot of things to follow. And there's a lot. And I love the different points of view. I love the bad guy point of view. I got a kick out of everything you wrote. Tell us a little bit about your background in writing. When did you get your very, very first book deal?
I got that. It came out in 2015. I got the deal. My first two books were nonfiction. Note to Self, A Seven-Step Path to Gratitude and Growth, and then The Business of Being, Soul Purpose in and Out of the Workplace. So those were my first two. And I was writing Note to Self at Hedgebrook, where women author change. That's their tagline, Hedgebrook, where women author change. But I saw this man across the way, and he was pushing a wheelbarrow, and he had a significant limp. And he looked like he was some type of a landscaper, groundskeeper. And I said to myself, based on that time and his age, I said, I wonder if he went to Afghanistan, if something happened there. And I tucked that into the back of my mind. And he is the inspiration for Sean McPherson. He is everything. It happened there, right then and there. I wasn't even there writing that book. But people who are authors or who want to be, any little thing can turn into a book.
That's so true, and it is why I call this joy on paper. It's that joy, you get this idea, and then you put it down on paper, and you just look back, at the paper, well, on the computer screen, and you say, my goodness, that's an idea, and then, and
yes.
I wrote that, and then you start, and then you can't stop, and then at
right.
one point, when you birth these characters, then they take over, and then what the heck, you just along for the ride.
Exactly, you're along for the ride, and that is absolutely the truth.
So, what are your own personal your background in reading? Now, you have explain
yes.
a little
I have
bit
my,
because that's important. That so many
yes.
of my people, I tell them read, read, read.
Yes, I read. I'll tell you my favorite authors. One person, her book, her name is Hank Phillippe Ryan. Even though she's a female, but her name is Hank Phillippe Ryan, and one of her books released today, The House Guest. She's one of my favorites. Robert Dugoni, David Baldacci, Brinza, he's in the UK, Keith Hooton, Louise Penny, the Inspector Gamache books. I love Louise Penny. Anne Cleves. I mean, I read mysteries, thrillers, suspense. Those are my favorite. I read other things, too. But I love to read other suspense thriller authors. I love crime fiction. And it's amazing how everybody writes something completely different. It's all about crime. I mean, that's the commonality. But we all do it so differently. And these people that I just named do it so exquisitely well. I'm in awe of them.
Well, and many of them have been on the program. David Baldacci's been on here, I think, 8 times.
Oh, wow.
He's been a frequent guest. And Dugoni, of course, has been on.
Yeah.
And he's going to be on again soon. So, yeah, it's it's just so much fun to read. And when I, as I was reading your characters, I said to myself, okay, Lord Peter Wimsey and Harriet Vane, you've got competition here.
That's great.
Now, I also want to recommend to people, and I've been doing this quite a bit, the classics that they should read, because it's so important, I think, that you have a background in reading classic books. So classic books, for me, of course, the ones that always come first are well, the three guys, really, I suppose, Darcy, you know, Mr. Rochester, and Heathcliff.
Right.
So I think that, you know, that's where I sort of look back on gentleman characters. Of those three,
right,
who do you like?
I'm in a little bit different vein than you. I'm like Animal Farm by George Orwell. I'm Dracula by Bram Stoker.
Oh.
I'm Fahrenheit 451. I'm Jane Eyre. I'm Moby Dick. I mean, give me 984, you know, George Orwell. I'm Of Mice and Men. I'm that kind of gal, because that was when I was going to school, in high school in the 70s. That was what we were fed. And for me, I liked it. There were a lot of people that shook their head no. I happened to eat it with a spoon.
Oh, especially, I'm glad you mentioned Moby Dick, because that is such, oh, it is so fantastic, and it is really a groundwork for writers. They, everybody, and as you said, in school, they don't present it right, but once you get into that book, it's such a revelation, and it stays with you forever.
Oh, yeah, I think it's all in the presentation. And sometimes, at least in my experience in school, it was a thing where it was presented like you had to do this. Now, most teenagers don't like that. If it's their idea, if somehow we could get reading to be their idea, and it turned out to be my idea, otherwise I wouldn't have. That's just the kind of person I am. But I actually loved it. Most of my peers did not. But I fell in love. I fell in love with it. My mom taught us, you know, to read way before most kids read, and she read to us, and then even when we knew how to read, she read to us and did the voices, the characters. She was amazing.
And that is so important, and I tell young people always, you know, young mothers and fathers, I say, read to your kids. Don't just, you know, give them books. Read, because that's what my mother did, the same exact thing.
Yes.
We started, you know, sitting on her lap, and we were poor, so we read comic books, and then as we, you know, got a little older, then she would read, well, she was reading, we had books like Dickens, and, you know, so she read a lot of those books to us. Even at a very young age, we started listening to Dickens, and we thought, oh, my goodness, you know, that was our whole excitement when she would read to us. So.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Oh, well, you know, back in the day when parents were allowed to spank, mine didn't. My mother would say, if I did something wrong, she'd say, Lori Jean, give me your library card. That was the worst thing anybody could do.
Oh.
I mean, it was like, oh, my gosh, because she knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to read. My favorite thing was to go to the library, ride my little bicycle to the library on Saturday, load up my bike basket with books and come home with those. And that was a delight. So a punishment for me was, Lori Jean, give me your library card. That just cut me off at the knees and I bled, you know?
Oh, don't you love when mothers use two names?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
I've only done that to my son a few times in his life, and he knows. Boy, if I use both names.
You're in trouble.
Oh, I love it. I love it. You're wonderful. I think it's fantastic. Well, you're fantastic. The book is fantastic. It's so exciting that we're going to have, we're going to have a baby in book five. Something to look forward to, because book four must be done by now.
Oh, yeah. It's at the editor, and we're on to, so we've got Indelible, Iconoclast, Impervious, Iniquity, Illusionist, innocuous, and I'm working on innocuous right now. And you might notice that all of the books start with the letter I, and they're four syllables long. I don't know why. I wanted something to be my signature, like Sue Grafton. She had the alphabet murders.
Yeah.
And I wanted a cool signature that's just my own. So when I wrote indelible, I love that word, just to say the word indelible. And I told my sister, it tastes so good. And she said, well, then have all of your words taste really good. So all of my books will always be an I word that is four syllables long.
Well, I was going to mention, Impervious is a wonderful, wonderful title. Now, your website is what? Just your name?
LoriBuchanan.com.
LoriBuchanan.com. People, get this book. All the books are starting with I. And Lori, you are fantastic. You paint a picture.
Thank you.
And you make us all very, very hungry as we go along. So if we gain weight, we're going to blame you.
Blame it on me.
Blame it on Lori Buchanan. And she will be always remembered as you open your fridge. Again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper. You are an absolute joy.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. Bye. Okay, let's go to commercials, okay? Okay.
Hello, fellow sci-fi readers. This is author Bria Burton reporting for Joy on Paper with your science fiction book buzz. Today's communique to galaxies near and far includes a 2022 series starter, Mickey 7 by Edward Ashton. The novel is available in print, ebook, and audiobook, with stellar narration by John Pirala. Soon to be a major motion picture called Mickey 17, starring Robert Pattinson. Now, let's download the book buzz. Every time Mickey dies, his body is remade and his uploaded conscience is downloaded into the next iteration, currently Mickey 7. As the ship's expendable, all life-threatening tasks get assigned to him. Multiples are forbidden. When he survives a fall into an icy crevasse thanks to the alien worm that carries him to safety, a shipmate had already reported him dead. Back in his room, Mickey 7 encounters Mickey 8, fresh out of the tank. Neither wants to dive back into the recycler, but can they pull off living as multiples? How hard can it be? Maybe it will make life easier for both of them. That is, until the daily rations get cut in half and Mickey's girlfriend starts to suspect something. A darkly humorous romp full of existential queries about the meaning of life, death, cloning, and immortality, Mickey 7 launches readers into a new page-turning sci-fi series with a sequel on the way. Author Edward Ashton has two other novels and over two dozen short fiction pieces published. He writes in a cabin in the woods in upstate New York. This is Bria Burton with your futuristic fiction fix, signing off.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest, New York Times best-selling author Mackenzie Lee. And the name of the book is Winter Soldier, Cold Front. Hi, Mackenzie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Wow, what a book, what a book. I'm holding it up to the camera. We're also on YouTube, so I just want people to see it. A rather startling cover there with the red star.
Yeah, it's a good one.
It's a good one. It is definitely a good one. Oh, this is so much fun. You have to explain exactly to my audience because, you know, I love dual timeline books. I really do. They're always, I get such a kick out of them. And of course, you are a historian, so you have dealt with the history of two very important periods of time. And tell us about this story and about the background, because you've done a marvelous job with this book.
Oh, thank you. Well, the book is about characters in the Marvel Universe. So I did some of it myself, but a lot of the work was done by the many, many other people who have worked with these characters and written about them and done comics and films and television shows about them. And it's been great fun and a great opportunity to be part of this universe and to be creating with so many other sort of unseen collaborators.
Well, you know, explain the storyline, because for those who don't know, that it is based on the Marvel character, James Buchanan, Bucky Barnes. That's Bucky Barnes, right?
Yep, that's it.
Tell us about him, and tell us how you got involved in writing the backstories here.
So Bucky's best known for being Captain America's sidekick. He's the sort of right-hand man of Captain America all through World War II. And then later in life, they're separated, and Bucky is captured by the Russians and becomes a brainwashed sleeper agent for the USSR. So half the timeline of the book is set in World War One, or excuse me, no, the other one, World War II, when Bucky's still sort of a young 16-year-old enthusiastic dummy who wants to be involved in the war and has no sort of understanding of what that really means, and has all these bright-eyed and bushy-tailed ideas about patriotism and heroism and what it means to be a good guy versus a bad guy. And then the other timeline is 15 years later in 1954, about him when he's an agent for the USSR. He's sort of lost his memory, he's been stripped of his identity, and the two missions, the one he's working on in 1941 and the one he's working on in 1954, end up intersecting and both becoming personal to him in a way he didn't expect.
And this is rather timely, because we're talking about the Cold War with Russia, and so people who are reading this book are going to discover a lot about Russia, a lot about the Cold War, and when we talk about Winter Soldier, I mean, right now, we have a lot of Russian Winter Soldiers.
It's certainly more relevant than I expected it to be when I started working on it.
I mean, when you think about it, and at one point, I don't know, we've probably very falsely believed that this could never happen again, that the Russians would be out there in the middle of winter, armies of them attacking people. But back in 1954 was really a Cold War with Russia, where America was, we were, you know, really going up against each other. Soon after that started the space race. So as a historian, you must have had fun working on these two storylines.
Yeah, I mean, the one is set in World War II, the other is the Cold War. Like you said, I got to pull from a lot of existing references that I really, really love. When I first pitched the book to Marvel, I talked about it in terms of like Jean Le Carre and the sort of spy who came in from the cold, George Smiley type books, which I really love. I'd also just watched The Queen's Gambit when we first started talking about this, which definitely seeps into the book in a lot of ways. My most favorite book in the world is a World War II novel called Codename Verity, and so I sort of brought all these references to the table and then got to go back and do sort of the real research and some of the same research these authors and creators had done to form a foundation for their work and then apply it to mine. I mean, it's every time period I work with, it's fascinating, it's exciting, you always learn something new. No matter how much I think I know going in, it's never enough, and I always end up learning more than I could have imagined.
Now, had you ever gone to Russia? Have you been there?
No, I haven't.
Okay, because it's before this, back in the 70s. It was you really did feel the Russian mindset, and it was frightening back then. So this is fascinating how you brought this character here. The scene at the beginning of the book. Wow, that's a great scene.
Thank you. Most of the book actually doesn't really take place in Russia. It's mostly in a variety of other places. The Bucky timeline takes place in London for most of it, and then the Winter Soldier's in kind of a bunker in Siberia, but then he goes to Latvia and Svalbard and a couple of other different places around the world. The Russian connect, the Russian setting is only sort of tangential.
But the Russian mindset is definitely in place there.
It definitely is. I mean, I think it's sort of essential when you're writing the Cold War era stories.
Now, when you were, this came to you as a, you presented it to them, the storyline, and they went with it, or?
We talked about, they signed me up to do 3 books about Marvel anti-heroes as teenagers, the sort of fan favorite morally gray characters. And I think we had initially talked about, the first one's about Loki, and we had sort of talked about that one right off the bat, but I came with Winter Soldier because he's one of my favorite Marvel characters, and they liked it and they were into it. And then from there I got to sort of pitch the storyline and collaborate with the geniuses at Marvel who know so much more about the comic history and what's going on in the larger world of Marvel than I do, and they were so receptive to everything I wanted to do, and then gave me sort of comic references to help me do it better.
Well, that must have been fun to work with them.
Yeah, it was wonderful. It was a wonderful process.
Well, because they have such vast resources, and they have all this backstory that they could provide you. When you finally sat down and started writing, did you really get into this feeling of understanding Bucky, particularly when he's 16, and understanding how 16-year-olds think?
Yeah, I mean, it's essential for every book you write to be able to get in the headspace of the character and to find empathy and understanding and common ground with them. Or else you're not doing your job as a writer. And I mean, part of it is bringing truth and your own true lived experiences and the things you. I try and bring myself and meet the characters where they are, and find common ground between us there.
Now, what is your background in my listeners are always interested in, since we went through November NaNoWriMo, many of my listeners finished their books in, you know, at the end of November. They started looking at them after being exhausted, you know, from the month of writing. They started, you know, looking at their books in mid December, now into January, and I started getting emails from author, you know, people who said, well, I am an author. I've written a book. I wrote 50,000 words in November. of course, I think they very quickly realize that they've got a lot to learn. And part of it, right?
It's a long way from writing that first book. Yeah. That's only the first step.
I know. And they are so excited. And now this year I didn't have it.
As they should be. It's such a tremendous accomplishment. Like, actually doing the thing and writing the book is more than 99.9% of most people do, but there's still a long slog from there.
Exactly. Now, when I first started this program, I had quite a few people who would come and say, well, I finished the book and I'm ready to send it off. Can you recommend an agent? And then I had to sort of, you know, well, now we're talking about bursting balloons. This is in the news. But I had to burst their balloon and say, I don't think so. Calm down. You've got to, you know, look at this as a serious business of a really, it is not just the fun of writing the book, as much fun as that is, there's also the craft behind it.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a lot of time and a lot of work and a lot of study. And, I mean, we think about writing as something you sit down and are immediately good at, or you sit down and you do and then you're done. Whereas it's really, it's a skill, like learning the piano or learning an instrument or a sport, is you don't immediately sit down and expect to be able to play Bach. You have to practice and you have to work at it and hone your craft and improve. And writing's just the exact same.
So what was it like for you when you had your first book published? How old were you then?
I was 25.
25. And so you had your first, do you remember that day?
When you got, oh, yeah, very clearly.
Tell us about that day.
It's weirdly anticlimactic to have a book come out, because you feel like your whole world has changed and you've accomplished this goal and you've done something that you've been working at for years and that for a lot of people has been a lifelong dream, and it's sort of like nobody notices but you. Like, it's an oddly dissonant thing to have happen. I remember in the moment it felt really sort of discouraging and weird, and I kind of couldn't get over the mental hurdle of reconciling this like tremendous accomplishment with the fact that like the world did not change in accordance with the huge change that I had gone through. But I've gotten better at that, and I've gotten better at sort of placing the value in other things and finding rewards in doing the work just for the sake of doing the work.
Well, your book, The Gentleman's Guide to Vice and Virtue, of course, was a New York Times best-selling book. Now, is that the one that you have a movie deal for?
Yes.
Yes? So tell us about that. You're anticlimactic. Oh yes, I just happen to have a movie deal.
Well, there's nothing really to talk about with the movie. It's people occasionally, if you're very lucky, someone will pay you for the option of making the movie, and then it sits on somebody's desk for a long time, and maybe it gets made and maybe it doesn't. So it's nice to sort of get the bump and get the boost. But it's, for me, the book coming out is enough. Like, if a movie happens, that would be great, and that would be a great sort of icing on the cake. But it's, for me, my work is pretty much done with that book, and my involvement with it is pretty much done.
But it's still nice to get optioned, definitely.
Yeah, it's very nice. I don't mean to be dismissive of it. It's just I have very little to say about the movie because it's the least involved I've been with anything about that book.
Well, it's funny because one of the things that I did when I worked in Hollywood, I would be given books, you know, to write a script for. So I looked at it from the other side of, you know, I would get the book and they'd say, write the script. And, well, as you said, it might be the least writing you'll do, because they really don't want usually the writer to have any input. But it is funny that when an author gets a deal like that, and you never know, sometimes it takes a long time, because unfortunately in Hollywood, I never worked on a script where there weren't at least five other scripts. You know, one person will do a script and then somebody will say, let's improve it. And, you know, they'll go on like that. But eventually, you know, you never know. And it was a very good book.
Yeah, no, you truly don't ever know. But I think that with movies, there's so much out of your control. And it almost, when you translate it into a different medium, it almost ceases to be the thing that it initially was to you. Like, so much has to change in order for it to be a movie. And people are going to have lots of opinions and feelings about that, and often people are not going to be happy with it. And for me, I've had to sort of just like divorce myself from the whole experience, because if it doesn't happen, I can't let that affect my feelings about the book and the accomplishment. And if it does happen and people hate it, I can't let that tarnish my feelings of accomplishment. So I've sort of had to like, and you just like you do, you can't get too excited or emotionally invested in anything until it's literally on your screen.
And of course, when you're writing a book and the characters become part of you, that's when it's fun, because you're in control.
Yeah, you get to make all the decisions.
And it's not that they always have to do what you want, because sometimes they do take over and sort of direct you where they want to go, right?
Right, yeah.
But that's the fun of writing, and that's the joy of writing. And I'm really so happy that you were able to join me today. I know that it's always a busy day when a book comes out, and this one is people have been really looking forward to this. I know there's a lot of buzz about it because, first of all, you're a great writer, and people recognize that. Writing is really fine, very fine. It's really excellent. And
thank you.
You know, pure talent. I have to tell people, you know, I've been really, today I've just been on a thing with really fine writing. I've been really lucky the past few weeks. Every book I read, I have to love it, you know, to talk about it. But I get this real excitement when a book is just so beautifully written. And you've done a great job here. And it's called The Winter Soldier, Cold Front. And it is, of course, a Marvel, based on a Marvel character, and a lot of people know that. And do you have a website? Well, you do have a nice website. I know.
I looked at it.
What's your website? Okay, I think maybe we dropped her, or she dropped us, or something like that. Anyway, she has a nice website. It is called Mackenzie Lee, and Mackenzie with an I at the end of Mackenzie, and her last name is Lee, and the name of the book is Winter Soldier. Really fine. Let's go ahead and do some commercials, and then I'll be back. I want to mention a few things about Bria Burton.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hey, and I am back. And I have a few minutes. I just want to talk a few minutes about Bria Burton. She is going to be the guest host here on Thursday. And I am so excited. She has two wonderful guests, Carol Stivers and Edward Ashton. It's just so wonderful when... She, first of all, she is so great at talking about sci-fi. So I'm really happy that Bria is going to be here and have these two wonderful guests. And I know she's going to really enjoy talking about Edward Ashton because he has a movie deal coming out, and his movie deal is a real deal. He's got a real movie coming, and it's going to be called Mickey 17, and she's going to investigate. The name of the book is Mickey 7, and she's going to find out why, when, and as you do in Hollywood all the time, you never know what they're going to do. They change the name of books, they change the name of characters, they change everything and anything they want. The author actually has no say, generally speaking, unless they have a really great intellectual property lawyer who protects every little thing. And that can happen. And some authors have things in their contract that exactly do not allow the studios to change. But then, of course, you might not get the deal because the studios, they love to change everything. They would change the silliest little thing, a name, just because they had never heard of the name before. They say, oh, well, we don't like that name. It's not, nobody ever heard of it. So they named everybody Smith. It was, used to drive me crazy. Anyway, we'll find out why Edward Ashton's book, Mickey 7, is now going to be a movie, a major feature film, Mickey 17. Who knows? But that's one of the wonderful things about working with Hollywood. You never know what's going to happen over there, and you never know what they're going to do with a book. Sometimes it's great, sometimes it's not so great, but for the author, what the heck? It's a lot of fun, and well, quite often, quite a bit of money, but not sometimes as much as you expect. Again, you need a great, great, great intellectual property lawyer. So if you people are signing contracts, please contact Bill Larson first. He's going to be on Joy on Paper in a few weeks, and he's going to be answering intellectual property questions. And you need him. Believe me, protect your rights. Because what you write is valuable. And it might not be valuable today. It might be valuable 10 years from now or 20 years from now. And there are authors whose books don't get made into film until after they're gone. So then their grandchildren are enjoying the benefits of a good, good intellectual property lawyer like Bill Larson. Anyway, everybody, remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry and her either one of her series. But I'm more and more, I'm thinking about Haunted Haven, because I would love to see a movie made right here, on right in location here in St. Petersburg. So you never know, and it could happen. It could happen to you. But meanwhile, say something nice to somebody. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed, for everything. I am very grateful to you, and I'm showing my gratitude, everybody. And he saluted me. I saluted him, because I should have been a general. I would have been so great. Everybody, and I would have spent that pension. Oh, and I would have also blown up that balloon. Everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful day. Bye-bye.